Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, offering crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
This is the July 30th edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Our panelists today include Ellen Dearden of AgReview out of Morton, Illinois, Del Durkles of AgriVisor from Bloomington, Illinois, and Mike Zuzolo at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting from Atchison, Kansas. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Get a list from each of you about the things that we ought to cover. I think, Mike, I'll start with you, Mr. Zuzolo, this time around.
Pre-report jitters, are we going to have any? And are we seeing improvement in the supply-demand fundamentals?
Ellen Dearden?
The fact that managed money lost a lot this month, with nearly every commodity down for the month.
And Del Durkles?
Well, the reports are natural to talk about, but somewhere along the way we could talk about the confusion regarding China, too.
Okay, I'd like to start in a different place, one that none of you have mentioned, but I want to know whether it's the supply fundamentals have actually changed in the last 2 weeks, in your opinions, for corn and or soybeans across the Midwest. Mike, I think we'll start out there with you in Kansas.
I don't think so, Todd. I think that the problematic areas for corn are not going to improve enough to shift the yield up that much at all. And the beans are still a question mark. Almost every producer to a T has said to me that August makes the bean yields. Don't ask me that question yet. But for the corn, I think that I'm getting a strong indication. Obviously, most of my producer clients are east of the Mississippi River, but they're saying it's not going to improve as much. I went back and looked at 2010 because that's been a model year for me in terms of good to excellent conditions. And to bottom line it out, if you look at the crop conditions of good to excellent conditions, we have 5.5 million more acres that are better off right now in 2015 than we were at the same time in 2010. But if you look at good to excellent conditions, 65% and lower, we have about 18 million more acres this year that are lower crop conditions, below 65%, than we had back in 2010. 2010's yield, average yield, ended up being 152.6. So those numbers support the idea that the central eastern Corn Belt cannot be made up for by the western states.
Since you dropped out a really low number at this point for 2010, I know that does not correspond probably to what you're thinking for the national average yield this year.
Right.
What kind of number are you considering?
I think it's really tough to get above 163 at this point based upon the weather diagnostics that the imagery that the NOAA tends to use and sends over to NAS. But the 160 to 163 number seems to me to be a good number to use right now.
Dale Durkles, your thoughts on the fundamentals of supply across the Midwest?
I would tend to concur with what Mike had to say. You know, I don't know that they've really improved any at all at this point. The biggest issue I think the trade's having difficulty with is, they know we have problems to some degree east of the Mississippi River, Missouri included. But everybody has this attitude that, well, the better crops west of the river are going to more than make up for that. You know, they're kind of forgetting last year in Illinois, that 200 bushel yield for the state, I mean, sticks out like a huge sore thumb in corn. And we had big yields in beans. In Iowa, or in Indiana, we had 188 bushel yield. But what people are forgetting, last year, Iowa had 178 bushel yield for their whole crop. That was only four under their prior record. Nebraska itself had 180,
it was 179 bushel yield, you know, and that was right snugging up against record. And you know, you've got these big yields out west. One of the Dakotas had a record last year that we had last year, Minnesota being really the only exception with 156 bushel yield, and that was off about 20 or so from the record. But Minnesota's corn crop's only half that of what Illinois and Iowa's is, each in or of each state. So, you know, I really question whether we can make up for that at this point. And I think going forward, we've got still a lot to learn about the crop itself, especially as we get to the end of the growing season, because what impact, especially east of the River Missouri and those places, did we have from leaching of nitrogen out with heavy rains that we've had?
Anything else to add on this topic of fundamental supply, Ellen Dearden, from you?
Well, I would say that the perception of the trade is that the crop is improving. And most of the agronomists that we look at are suggesting otherwise. But perception is what's been driving this market.
You want to talk a little bit about managed money and some of the losses and the impact that has in the market. Why is that the case?
Well, the commodities market has really become a money flow market, and it's a new instrument that funds have been using to trade in and out of to make money. They don't care if the market's going up, they want to be long. If the market's going down, they want to be short. And in the managed futures, it's been a real losing month for things. Really, almost all commodities, except perhaps hogs, will close down for the month. That just speaks volumes to me, especially on these index funds that always take the long side. So they're getting squeezed rather mightily at this stage of the game. The new month begins Monday, and they may come in and do something very different and want to be long the market again. But they're going home here at the end of this month as losers.
Now, so explain that to me just a little bit. So you're dividing, and I understand some of it, but I want to understand it better, the managed money as compared to maybe black box trading money and the size of those two in terms of volume and the impact on from one on the other. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. We've got a lot of different kind of money, speculative money that comes into this market. The black box traders tend to be very short-term traders. And when I say short-term, they are certainly in and out of the market several times during the day. They play for quarters, half-cent moves. Some of these index funds get long, stay long until they have a signal that says get out of the market, but they're not turning short. Then we have managed futures that are intermediate term futures. Maybe they hold positions for several days. But this money flow has just been a huge influence in the market since the 90s.
Dale, I think this brings me to the question you laid out at the beginning of our program and confusion as maybe it relates to China. I'm not sure that this is the case. And also to the money flows that have been moving in many commodities in the Chinese stock market and in and or out of the gold market because of the Chinese economy. Can you lay out a situation for this and what this confusion has meant?
Well, in the grains in particular, you know, the equity market itself, what's happened here over the last couple of weeks in China, I think people have exaggerated to a certain degree its impact. You know, the Chinese equity markets, as I read here, account for about 8% of the total capitalization of their economy versus here in the U.S., you know, our equity markets are somewhere around 35-40% of the total capitalization of our economy. So you've got a much narrower group of people, albeit wealthy ones, that have been impacted by this, and it certainly has psychological implications, but I don't think it has as big an impact as what we otherwise might think. I suspect, though, that the break in the equity markets that we have had probably caused some people that had long positions in equities over there, if they had long commodity positions going with it, probably were being forced out of commodities to shore up their equities. I think, though, the big confusion in the mix in here is people continue to talk about the wheat and corn inventories worldwide and forgetting the impact China has on this.
How?
Well, you know, I've long looked at fundamental numbers, wheat and corn outside of the United States, looking at balance tables to try to get some kind of a sense of how that impacts things coming back into the U.S. as far as demand for our wheat or coarse grains. You know, and over the last few years, I've started to look at the fundamental structure outside of both the U.S. and China. And the reason I've taken China out of the mix is these huge inventories that they have. You know, there's some people privately want to say the government may own 150 million ton of corn, but I think that's a ridiculous exaggeration. But I think there's not a great understanding, not that I have one, about how these inventories are going to compact and affect the market. We do know right now that, you know, world market prices for corn are roughly about $350, $370 underneath what the government paid for corn this year. You know, and I don't see the government coming into the fray and starting to liquidate those inventories that they own more aggressively and taking a $3 to $4 hit in the price by selling the grain that they own. I think going back in the game, they're going to probably tend to stay and hold those inventories. They are, it said, going to come in with a new policy, you know, in support of producers, in which case they're going to allow prices that they pay to producers really be market driven. But I think those inventories, they will maintain until such a point we get a world market rally, world prices go up. And then when that differential narrows down, yeah, maybe then they start selling these inventories out into the market there, maybe even export them out of the country. So in effect, it's going to be a cap over the market, much like the original reserve program did here in the U.S. I don't think they're important today. And if you look at corn and wheat, fundamental structure outside of the U.S. and China, we're tighter than we've been any time going back to somewhere around 08, I think it is, in wheat, and maybe 07 in coarse grains.
Okay, so Mike Suzalo, you look at the global economy a great deal. How do you see China playing into the marketplace in the last 2 weeks and then going forward?
Well, to build off of what Dale and Ellen were talking about, I think the market in the last month, and this is why many of what we would call the global macro funds that are not black box traders have been hit so hard, Todd, what they've experienced is the equities route is directly related to the market perception, right or wrong, that global inflation is going down. Why? Because China equals global inflation in the last 20 years. I mean, I was looking at some statistics about how big has China gotten, and when it comes to the metals markets alone, almost all of the increase in global consumption between 2000 and last year was China, almost all of it. And when you look at it from that perspective and you see an equities market break, and it's been funded in part by government policies that allow margin trading, much like a commodity margin account, and over-leveraging of these investors. Granted, they're new investors, so they haven't hurt the market that much yet, and it hasn't hurt the overall economy that much yet. But when you have a government doing things like this, I think it simply spells out to the market, the general marketplace, that international trade is slumping because commodity deflation is coming, because China is not growing as much, and in fact, China is actually hurting the commodity demand. And you know, one of the stocks that are near and dear to my heart, and I say this laughingly, but Anheuser-Busch reported on Thursday that their volumes in the last quarter fell about 6.5% in China, not just because of poor weather, but also because of economic headwinds. You've got a list from Caterpillar to DuPont to many, many other major corporations saying we're seeing a slowdown, in some case rapid slowdown, and I think it boils back down to the oil, boils back down to the copper, the gold, and then those commodity indices that track those three commodities that also have grains and livestock in them, they end up going down just by default, and that's why you have such an abysmal month by those commodity funds. Now, one really big bright spot and a major reason why I'm holding pat on my hedges right now is it's not because of the improving macro fundamentals, but it is because we're seeing pork values rise in China. It's not deflationary everywhere, and food actually looks pretty optimistic in the next 6 months, in my opinion. In fact, some of the prices have gone up about 50% in Beijing since the mid-March low. Pork rump prices across 50 cities that I track is up 20% year on year. Protein is back in fashion, whether it's because of supply cuts over there, I really don't care. It's indicative that the demand is there. And so I think that the pork is back in fashion. That has helped the protein market in general this past week, and we've seen meal once again carry the flag for the whole commodity complex. I like that scenario, and it takes pressure off of me to worry about beans leading the market lower. So going into that August 12th report, I feel like even though the macro fundamentals are looking really, really vulnerable and tough, we've got enough supply-demand fundamentals between the pork price in China, Asian weather, European weather, El Nino talk, and like Ellen said, they're pricing in a big yield anyway, that we can hold pat here for right now and adjust once we see USDA's figures.
Let me see if I can summarize this very quickly, and then you can tell me whether you think I'm fairly accurate on the summary, and all three of you can do that. So if we think longer term and we think about the economies of the 1970, we had a big boom in the commodity markets as the Soviet Union began to more industrialize. They came into the markets and they began to import goods and services. And then we had a settling out or a settling back in the marketplace. But we essentially doubled the price of commodities. This time around, we've gone through with China coming into the marketplace in a very, I guess, similar fashion, relatively speaking, in terms of industrialization, creating a middle class. This time, that middle class is huge, something like 900 million people. And now we're settling back, and we're not looking for a deflation back to the old levels, but a higher plateau where we might double prices again. So if you think of, and let's just use crude oil, $33 a barrel to, or $28 a barrel to $54 or $66 a barrel instead of $150 or whatever we went to as a top, $140-something. And corn from $242 to $260, or $460. Soybeans into that, if the University of Illinois numbers are right, around 11 or 11.20 or something along those lines. Is that, relatively speaking, where you think we all are and what you just explained to me?
I think so. I mean, investment demand versus actual demand, that's what it's about. If we're looking at the Gulf corn price right now, it's literally, what, 15% below a year ago levels, and our stocks-to-use ratios for coarse grains are identical to last year, last July at this time. Last July's report, this July's report are identical. To me, almost all of this break in price has been investment demand, commodity index demand related, not actual demand related.
Yeah, so we're settling out. I think that's the way I wrote it up in last weekend's newsletter that I had released from willag.org. Let's move forward and then look towards the August 12th reports. There may be some jitters as we move that way. Ellen Dearden, what are the numbers you'll be watching for? The WASD figures and crop production report are due out.
My eyes are going to be on the bean numbers. And really, the harvested acres on beans, I think, is going to be what catches my attention. We certainly have talked a lot about plantings, if they're right, if they're wrong. I don't believe we're going to see changes there at all, but we may see fewer harvested acres on the beans, probably on the corn as well, but primarily on the bean number. I think yields at this stage of the game are just, you know, pie in the sky, so I think the acres are going to be what I'm looking at. Ending stocks on beans for 2014-15 crop going to be critical because they become the beginning stocks for the 15-16 crop.
Mike Zuzula?
To offset, if we still have the negative fundamentals in the outside market and the dollar going up, I think we need to see the world wheat numbers go down. I agree wholeheartedly with what Ellen just said. We need to trim the 15-16 ending stocks one way, shape, or form. I also think the biggest factor to these recent reports has been kind of a consistent policy and movement by USDA to rob Peter to pay Paul, so that you really don't lose that comfortable feeling that we've got ample supplies. And I think there's enough weather issues out there. Are they going to get ahead of this and start projecting some lower volumes, lower supply numbers, or are they going to keep this continued policy? Because it just keeps the market comfortable and feeling good about itself.
And I know, Dale, that you have been looking at these numbers as well.
Yeah, you know, I went through the process on corn in particular of looking at historical stuff on plant population, ear stock ratios, and things of that ilk, and old USDA reports. And I applied actually a six-year average ear weight against it, kicking out 2012, so I end up with a five-year ear weight, which tends to be a good starting point for USDA on their data-driven model. But I came up at 163.7 for them on August, and my corn crop's at 13.22. You know, and the real issue, if they don't change their demand numbers, you start driving a ending stocks number new crop easily below 1.4 billion bushel, maybe down closer to 1.3. And when you look at the price, or you look at the relationship between ending stocks and stocks use versus average price, we should be somewhere over 4.5. That's something people got to think about. Beans yield wise, you know, it's really always hard at this point because we don't get any hard data from the USDA and what they use. My condition rating models have been reasonable in the past at giving me a feel on bean yield for August. I'm at 44.5, but, you know, who knows where we come out on that because they have other things to work with that we don't get to see. The other thing I put in here that's really important is the report that comes right behind the August 12th crop report. Traditionally comes the 15th, but that's on a Saturday, so it'll either be the Friday or the Monday. We get that first FSA preliminary planting report. I don't think the corn or bean acres necessarily are important on it, but I think the prevent plant numbers are huge and something people shouldn't ignore, because you can take their prevent plant numbers they issue on that and generally come from pretty close within, I'm talking about 300,000 or 400,000 acres of what their final prevent plant number will be. So that one on a back end side will tell us something about the USDA numbers, I think, for soybean plantings more than anything else, and what kind of adjustment may be coming in October.
All right. As we wrap up, I want to talk a little bit about basis, in particular for those states east of the Mississippi River and even to the east of us, Indiana, Ohio, because there certainly will be some really tight basis levels, overs for old crop corn and soybeans, very tight basis levels, I think, for new crop. Ellen Dearden, when producers are looking at short crops in those areas, and they also are looking at really good basis levels, do they need to lock them in some form?
I would say yes, particularly if people are looking at this November-December slot rather than fall slot. I think by fall, we're going to know the number of bushels, and perhaps the basis will be shifting around, but I like locking in this November-December basis. The thing that really hits home to me is I think the strong, strong old crop basis crusher demand on the bean side is an attempt to move Minnesota beans into Indiana and Ohio. 90 over can work.
I was going to ask you successful or not, but 90 over might work, huh? Dale or Mike, do you have anything to add on that topic of basis and what producers should be doing?
You know, the one thing I would say, you know, as far as corn is concerned, you know, the issue with old corn is going to be different than new corn, because old corn, we still hear a lot of stories around where producers still have a fairly sizable inventory of corn to price yet, you know, and then it starts to become a matter of do they want to carry it on into new crop? Are they going to move it before, you know, harvest is concerned? And even though, you know, I think that that you know, basis will give way, I would worry a little bit about this old corn basis, even in the short term time frame. You know, I think you got the next couple of weeks and beyond that, you got to be starting to get a little careful. The new crop, you know, when you look at Illinois, except for, let's say, the western edge, that's going to get some repercussions from what's going on in the western corn belt. But once you get away from there, the new crop corn basis, I think it's going to be a reverse inflection of what we see unfold on the futures market. You know, if we would get a rally as we go through fall and then into winter, Mike talked about 2010 as being a possible corollary. You know, and that's what we did that year. You know, we'll see this basis give up a little bit, but I'd worry more about that out in the western corn belt than eastern corn belt. But still, on new crop, we could lose some ground if, in fact, the paper market starts moving moderately higher.
Mike Zuzulo, anything to add, and then on to your final word for the day?
No, agree with Dale and Ellen wholeheartedly. I will point out Decatur is a good month or a good market to use for the area we're talking about, Todd. Get above 40, 50, 60 cents a bushel on basis. That's got to be looked at if the Decatur market gets that hot. I guess my final word is, as I said, I'm holding pat on 15 hedges mainly because of improving supply-demand fundamentals, mainly improvement on the protein side. Nice to see the livestock market rally as the Chinese equity market doesn't rally. And as the dollar rallies, I think that's worth looking at and worth holding on to, especially given the price that we're at in December corn in particular. I still worry after the report that if we're not given a bullish bean report, the soybeans resume their leadership to the downside. And so as long as I have beans on my side and meal on my side, I feel a lot more comfortable holding on as these macro issues develop.
Mike Zuzulo, of course, is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. He's in Atchison, Kansas. Ellen Dearden is in Ag Review. She's in Morton, Illinois. Ellen?
The thing that really startled me this week was how easily the cattle and hog market seemed to gain ground. I know we've got cheap feed out here, but I've been looking for some lows in both these markets, and I think they may be in place. We may see cattle work higher all the way into the end of the year.
And Dale Durkles of AgriVisor.
You know, one thing I recommended to clients this week, I put some bull call spreads on in new crop corn and new crop beans and basically positioning them to go ahead and have those in place to sell into with cash sales or hedge to arrive contracts or whatever as we get on into the fall itself, because I think this is going to be a realizing bull market. I'm still basically a major bull attitude.
Our panelists on Commodity Week today have included Ellen Dearden of AgriView out of Morton, Illinois, Dale Durkles of AgriVisor from Bloomington, Illinois, and Mike Zuzulo at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting from Atchison, Kansas. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 12th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold is at agrigold.com.